Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us for the Wise Women Media, the radio show. We come at you every Friday night at 10 o'clock. I want to encourage everybody to check us out online at wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. You can find a list of our sponsors there, links to our social networks, ways to get in touch with us, complete show archives, and all kinds of other information. We want to give a shout out to Here Be Monsters on Blog Talk Radio, which gives us this time slot every week. And we also want to encourage you to check out the other shows on the Here Be Monsters Network, which is an affiliate of the Commons Project Network. Here Be Monsters also has The Ceremony, Spirit Therapy Radio, The Sunday Show, and Gwen Stefani and all the rest that are doing these shows are amazing. And also, we have all agreed that we are going to dedicate our shows to peace, and we want to make sure that that vernacular, that that narrative shows through in how we broadcast and what we broadcast, that we do not follow what our government is saying about the endless wars. So wanted to make that clear, and I wanted to introduce our guests. We're going to be having a free-for-all, so feel free to give us a call at 213-816-0357. We couldn't get the chat room open, but if you're interested in chatting with us and you would like to post questions, you can do that on the Facebook page for Wise Women Media. I am also on Skype under Anita Stewart. That's A-N-I-T-A-S-T-E-W-A-R-T. So you can post your questions there, and I will be checking them out during the broadcast, and I'll read them live on the air. Hopefully by next week we'll be able to have the chat room open. I also wanted to encourage you all to check out the GoFundMe link on wisewomenmedia.blogspot.com. We are listener-supported, independent media. We take no corporate sponsorship. So anything that you can drop in there at the GoFundMe link is greatly appreciated and helps us stay on the air every week. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce and bring on the line Sherry Roberts and Christine Coe. Ladies,
hello.
Ladies, are
hello.
You with me?
I'm
good.
I'm
well, have you both on the show. And I wanted to start with Christine so she can tell everybody a little bit about herself and how she got involved in journalism. So, Christine, you got the floor.
Hello, everyone. I've been involved in journalism, I'd have to say, my entire life. I'm that typical Libra. I am absolutely passionate about anything I get involved in. And I started writing at a young age, and that's spilled over my political passions about the world around me. I've been an activist. I would have to say I started out in childhood and just kept on going, and that spilled out in my writing. So journalism has pretty been that golden thread, that lifelong thread. I've just always had this inherent need to be involved in the world around me. In other words, wherever I am, wherever our circles are, there we can affect a change. And so for me, my gift was writing and storytelling, communicating and conveying ideas, and it just was a natural extension of it. So
and then,
I continued.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, so I continued on. I attended UCLA and began studying officially journalism. And then from there, when I was wrapping up and getting my degree, I continued on to study TV and film because I wanted to be able to communicate in all forms of media.
Okay.
That's awesome.
That's great. And for a short time, you were working with the TV show The Doctors. How was that experience?
That was amazing. I have to say, nutrition and holistic medicine was equally a strong part of my life for about nearly two decades. So obviously, that was some of the important part of my communication. And that's how I got involved in The Doctors, really. It was a marriage of alternative medicine and that industry. And putting shows together was really fascinating. Each week we would start off with an idea, start off sometimes with a question and explore it, and we put a show together in a week's time, sometimes two shows.
Okay, Sherry, how did you get started? For our listeners, you are kind of your own little media conglomerate under Sherry Speak. Yeah, and your blog really has some interesting stories, well-researched, well thought out, and definitely topics that a lot of people aren't covering. So tell us a little bit about how that started.
I actually started writing as a child, and I just, like Christine had said, I really love telling stories. And when I was a child, I wrote a lot of fiction. And when I was in high school, I was an accelerated student, and we moved very, very often. So I would go to 2, 3, and 4 schools a year. So I was always a new kid, and I was at the point where I was an honor roll student. However, they had switched the credit system, and I was not able to accumulate enough credits because we would move before semesters and stuff would be over. And so I had moved back to California at one point as a teenager and was in 10th grade, and they wanted to raise me a grade, and I didn't like that idea. My mom didn't like that idea. They had a new program down in California, in Buena Park, at the schools that I was going to there, that I had an option where I could be an accelerated student without skipping a grade, but I could take college classes. So I took some journalism classes because I loved to write, and it was then that I found out that I loved nonfiction, that I liked writing real stories. And so it kind of went from there, but, you know, I have 3 adult children now, but, you know, all the time I was raising them, I had to be a mommy and work full-time to make a lot of money and, you know, to pay the bills and all that. And it was after, you know, and I still wrote and I still did stuff, and I did stuff as an activist as well, but I didn't have time. I was working, you know, a full-time job plus a part-time job in my own business. Hello?
Oh, okay. Yeah, we lost you for a second. Can you repeat that last sentence?
Oh, I was just saying that, you know, I had, you know, I had to work the jobs full-time. I had a part-time and a full-time job, and raising the kids, so it didn't leave me a lot of time to write. A lot of people ask what my hobbies are, and I still say writing is a hobby for me, too, because I like to write other things, not just things I get paid for. But once my kids were grown and gone, I was still working in corporate media, and I was still kind of chasing that almighty dollar, but yet I didn't have the home anymore. I didn't have all the cars anymore. I didn't have kids at home, and I'm like, what am I doing? You know, and I did some soul searching, and it was like, you know, it's time for me to kind of live my dream. And I sacrifice a lot in order to do it, because I do write full time, and it's hard. It's a struggle. You know, the stuff that matters most to me that's on SherrySpeak.com is the stuff I don't get paid for, like all the stuff I did on Rupert and all of that. You know, and I write about a lot of, you know, hardcore current events now. The stuff I get paid for is stuff that doesn't interest me at all. You know, and it's more filler and content, and, you know, or I, you know, I enjoy when I'm writing ad copy or something like that. But, you know, so my thing was is just kind of being able to tell the truth. And when I don't watch TV anymore, but when I used to watch TV, I would see things and they didn't seem so, you know. And so when the internet came about, made it a lot easier for people to start researching a little better and so on and so forth. And then I started realizing that a lot of these things really were not so. And it kind of went from there, you know. And then 9/11, you know, came and happened. And so now I predominantly write all nonfiction. I've written a book that I've not tried to publish yet. I, you know, I do magazine articles, hard magazine articles. It's been a while, but I do them. But I do a lot of online writing for different people. And like I said, the stuff that's on my site is the stuff I care about. It's the stuff that's about social justice. It's the stuff about, you know, the things that are all the current events that are impacting us, you know, on a daily basis, wars and 9/11, which still impacts us today. So, you know, that's kind of how I did it, Anita.
I'm going to just open this up for a couple questions, and I'll start with Christine. What do you think, Christine, are the 3 most underreported stories that you've heard probably in the past week? I understand that might be a tough question, just so you know, might need just a second to think about that. But things that you heard about that you didn't hear on the networks. I keep an eye on the networks. That doesn't mean I listen to everything that they say, but I certainly like to see what's underreported or not reported at all that we're here, us who are on the net often are hearing about.
Well, you know, actually, yeah, you caught me off guard because that's one of my pet peeves. And when I know what I'm angry that isn't getting reported on, I know very well. I also don't follow the networks more than keeping an eye on them because, like Sherry, it doesn't take long to look at the world and listen to the network news and know that you're being lied to. And then, too, I studied the history of the whole propaganda machine, and I could never just sit there and watch it and swallow it. But, okay, so today, I don't know. I'm sure the world has heard, but I know it's gone underreported, and that is, you know, we've had a couple of instances of domestic terrorism. That's true domestic terrorism, and not Eric Holder's version of domestic terrorism. That is where the patriotic American is speaking out and holding a constitution. But we had a beheading. We had a case of anti-Semitism. And I've been keeping an eye out for cases of anti-Semitism and possible domestic terrorism in the United States and Canada for a while, and you don't hear anything about it. Secondly, would be all the cases of police brutality. We get every once in a while a big case, you know, it makes the headlines, homeless woman, and she earns $1.5 million, but I think that if you were to watch the network news, you would believe that that was not such a common occurrence as it is. An emerging police state, I think, goes underreported. And thirdly, the network news keeps reporting about this economy that's emerging and growing and improving, and the truth about the economy is absolutely not reported. So in that case, I wouldn't even say underreported. I think that the propaganda is being used to prop up this narrative that we're all doing okay and it's not as bad as it feels like at home, and that's an absolute lie.
Okay, let's go with Sherry, and maybe you have three other stories that you that interested you that didn't get on the mainstream media. And I like to use Cindy Sheehan's phrase for that, lamestream media.
I like how the Project Censored crew, they take the mainstream out of it because we aren't the new mainstream media, but, you know, just the corporate media. You know, actually, Anita, I'd like to talk about a couple of stories that are in the news, except these parts of the stories are not in the news. So to tag team on what Christine just said about the police brutality, today I spent the majority of the day with Dylan Avery, who most people know from Loose Change. He's a great documentary maker and is a wonderful photographer. And he and I have been talking. He's been working on a new documentary called Black and Blue. And there's a Facebook page for Black and Blue that has the teaser trailer is up now. It just went up like about a week ago on Facebook. If you just do a search for Black and Blue, and we can put the link on Whitestone Media on a post.
I heard about that, but I wasn't sure what it was. So I'm actually looking it up right now.
Dylan Avery is just really good at what he does, and as he's gotten older, you know, he's learned a lot, you know, as far as, you know, the vetting and all of that. But he's putting together a documentary, and now I want to be clear here. His documentary, Black and Blue, although about police brutality, it is not an anti-law enforcement documentary. It's not all down on the man. It's, you know, in that sense. Here's what we don't hear in the news about police brutality. He interviewed me today because of my situation with the West Valley Detention Center that we discussed a few weeks ago and that I wrote a story about. And the thing is that, you know, we hear about all this brutality, but most often in the media, the only time we hear about brutality is if there's race involved, first of all. Mm-hmm. And so you don't hear about a white woman like me getting beat up. You know, very rarely you'll hear something, but the majority is it'll make the news. And a lot of times that's to be politicized. You know, we have an African-American president, and so people like to try to pull that up and use that race card. You know, and this, that, and the other. We have the whole gun control thing, you know, and so on and so forth. So these are, you know, different things to be politicized. But with regards to the police brutality and stuff, it's not just a matter, and I spoke deeply with Dylan today about this, it's not just a matter of brutality and excessive force, all of that sort of stuff. We're in an era of really, you know, not all cops are bad, but the bad ones that are bad, they're real bad, you know. And there is this aggression that, from my perspective, really began after 9/11. We went from peace officers to cops that look like Darth Vader, you know, and in their riot gear and stuff. And it's not about protecting and serving anymore. You have law enforcement officials that specifically try to provoke you into doing something wrong, you know, or actionable on their part. Now, for instance, there was a story that I just posted, and I was trying to look for it right now. I didn't know you were going to ask this question. But on my Facebook page, I posted a story, I think it was yesterday. There was a woman, and I can't remember where, but there was a woman that had been pulled over, or a car had gotten pulled over for a regular traffic violation. The passenger, the woman passenger, there was a kitchen spoon on the seat beside her that had, like, red residue, dried residue on it. And immediately when the cops saw this, got very aggressive with the woman, and they ended up arresting her for possession, drug possession, okay? They arrested her, and she ended up being in jail for over a month. She tried to tell them from the minute what was on the spoon, it was dried spaghetti sauce, and they wouldn't listen to her. And so she did all that time in jail, and guess what? She was 100% correct. There was absolutely no drug, not even a little bit of a residue. Now, whatever state she lived in, I want to say it was like Nebraska or something like that, but whatever state she lives in, I can tell you this part that I remember, is even trace drug residues found on a person is like a 2-year sentence, okay? So the test finally came back when they did the test on this, but again, she was in there over a month. To come back, it was SpaghettiOs sauce. You know, so we have this over-policing, this weird aggressiveness that's going on, and it's no longer where you feel like the police are your friends. Like when we were kids, you know, the police were your friends. If the police showed up, you know, somebody was being helped, not hurt, you know. And the reality is, and like I was trying, as I was telling Dylan today, is that the police now, I understand there's different kinds of violence now. We have the whole gun control thing going on, all the talk on that, you know, whether you're for it or against it doesn't matter to me right now in the conversation. What does matter is, and I've said this before, and I think you've heard me, Anita, is we have these debates, these public debates. They're not debates. We're just sitting here bickering about something, keeping it as a talking point so it can continue to get politicized. And then what happens? Nothing, absolutely nothing gets done. We're still having a gun debate. We're still having a police brutality debate. We're still having a 9/11 debate, for that matter, you know, 13 years later. So what do we do? Well, I can probably guarantee you, not that I actually don't have neighbors right around me, but if I had a neighbor on every side of the house I'm in, I would guarantee you that 3 out of those 4 neighbors would have no idea anything about the problem of police brutality, and all they're seeing is what is being shown on the news, on the regular corporate media television. And so they're in agreement that so-and-so, they got shot for a reason, and it's okay that they're dead, and it's okay that the cops did this, and excessive force is okay. We live in a fear society now, which brings me to story number 2, is ISIS. Now, we're hearing ISIS, 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 you know, until we're blue in the face. But what we're not hearing about is how this war we now have with Syria, on top of the other ongoing wars that we have, are part of a plan that was not only written and documented, but a plan that was published in September of 2000, 1 year before 9/11. And that plan's name is called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and it was written and put out by the Project for the New American Century. Now, in that plan, it says that they, in order to increase their military budgets and do these things that they needed to do, in order to control resources in the Middle East, they needed, quote, multiple simultaneous theater wars in the Middle East. How many more do they need? What we have seen, but yet is not being pointed out in corporate media, is the language that's being used about this war and the lead up to it. It's not the same language Obama was speaking a year ago with regards to Syria, if everybody remembers. Okay, but
right.
What we do have is we have the same fear kind of propaganda language going on now. ISIS is going to do something in America. Fox News was putting it out on the anniversary of 9/11. We're expecting a potential imminent threat and this, that, and the other. Okay, well, here's the deal. We created ISIS just like we created Al-Qaeda, just like we created all these other ones. They're using our U.S. military, you know, ammunition and weaponry, okay, not all that was stolen, just like Al-Qaeda was using our weapons because we armed them, okay? We keep doing this over and over and over, but America, with technology and the microwave society and the me society, they are not seeing anything long enough to move beyond an opinion, to get to a fact, to find a solution. My third pick, Anita, would really actually just be, again, that in the media, I mean, I'll listen to talk radio. I listen to all different kinds of stuff, not just something that I want to hear. You know, our worlds are as small as we make them. And so if we only surround ourselves by like-minded people, then we don't grow and evolve as people. So I participate in listening and consuming media and stuff, and just not TV, unless it's The Voice. I'm seeing all this different kind of propaganda, and when Christine was talking about the economy is such a non-story. The only time we really hear much about the economy is if somebody wants to say that whatever president's in office created some jobs, or the Fed might do something with the interest rate, you know, but that's really all we hear. What we're not hearing is that the economic problems that the United States of America has today are rooted in 9/11. What we're not hearing is that the majority of the major touch-us-now problems that we have in the United States of America are rooted in 9/11, 13 years ago. And why are all these problems still here? Because it's not correct. We didn't do it right. And so they're able, the big non-story that we're not hearing is the stories that Project Censored, tells. They're the stories that are under or non-reported, and you have to dig deep to find them. But if you don't understand vetting, if you don't understand that just because the Internet says something doesn't mean it's true, you can't do anything. So we have corporate media out there that talks badly of alternative media, and pretty fairly with some. I mean, when you think about people like Alex Jones, it's fair, you know. But we're not talking about how to fix these problems. And it all starts with that media that we're listening to.
Okay. That is a lot of food for thought. Let me ask Christine, what is your take on the term conspiracy theorist or conspiracy theory? I get really irritated by people who sling that term around. Tell me what your take is on it.
Thank goodness you said that, because immediately when you start to say that, the adrenaline, the blood, I need to look in the mirror. I know I'm getting red because I get so heated when I hear that. A conspiracy theory stops being a theory when it becomes a fact, and it's only a theory while it's being planned and meditated upon. I'm sorry, the original question is, what is my take on conspiracy theory?
What is your take on the term?
A dirty word to immediately invalidate an alternative narrative. So the moment Americans, the public, alternative form of media, the moment an alternative narrative emerges, then it must be a conspiracy theory, which means it must be a nutcase, which means it must be absolutely wild and untrue, and we don't even need to look at it. Those people are kooks, the theory is kook, and it's a way of perpetuating the one single approved indoctrinated narrative, and it keeps people from being exposed to the truth and to other avenues, other facts, other alternative narratives that might and often do. I honestly, when I hear the term conspiracy theory, it makes me take a harder look, because I know that there's a force there that is purposely trying to shield me from an opposite opinion or an alternate opinion.
Right. That is exactly what I think too. It's more or less someone being very troll-like. They don't want you to get to the truth, and if you do get to the truth, they don't want you to put the truth out there so others hear it.
You know, I think about science. That was my first academic pursuit. And with science, although that's not always true today anymore, even in the scientific community, you can never, ever, ever rule out any theory, any wild conjecture. And likewise, you can never invest yourself in one theory, in one outcome. That is not the way that you scientifically arrive at any truth. And you can go back through history in time where mankind invested itself in a certain theory and would burn people at the stakes for having an alternative opinion, and yet we can look back and say, wow, how backwards were they to hold to that? And so it's the same thing when it comes to political discussion or social discussion, anything in the media. The minute you hold fast to one particular idea and rule out everything else as conspiracy or wild conjecture, you're really disabling yourself from getting to the truth.
Have you ever been called a conspiracy theorist?
All the time.
Yeah. And Sherry, what's your take on it? Do you have anything different to say than what Christine said about this?
Actually, I do. We talked about this when we did the Rupert Show, Anita. Conspiracy theory as a term, when you're calling somebody that, I agree with everything that Christine said. However, one of the things for us writers and anybody that's doing a website or whatever, the term conspiracy theorist can't go away. It's a major search term. And so people that are writing on these topics from our perspective, not the naysayer's perspective, we still need to use those because the choir already knows, and the people outside the choir are going to be using that search term. So we have to, you know, we have to keep in mind that a lot of these terms and catchphrases, you know, like a hashtag now, you know, they all have a purpose, and with all the different algorithms and whatever with the search engines and stuff. So, you know, we have to learn to embrace certain things, you know, and like say, okay, you know, yeah, it's an insult because conspiracies are real and theories are real. That's all.
Okay, I'm going to flip this to something completely different because I feel that it's something that should be covered on this show. I had promised my listeners that we were going to do a wrap of what happened last weekend with the People's Climate March. And I wasn't able to get any specific guests. I wanted to get a panel of people together, and that didn't happen. So I think it's better that we have the two of you. So I'll start with Christine. Christine, did you watch the march? And the second part of this question is, what do you think, if anything, was accomplished by this march as a long-term strategy?
I was not able to watch the march. I was traveling, so I did read about it. I am aware of it. I did see pictures, was overwhelmed. I think it's not quite 500,000, 400,000 are estimated to have been at the march.
The same amount as Woodstock.
Yeah.
That's how I compared it. Yeah, amazing.
It is amazing because, you know, I just think of the empty polling booths, you know, at voting time. I think, where are all these people when our rights are being eroded and ripped from us? And I was really surprised to see that kind of a turnout. I'm probably not going to have the popular opinion here, and that I do not favor UN or government control carbon taxing at all. I believe I was involved in Greenpeace, another one of my childhood activism. I believe in being a good steward of the earth, but I think you have to follow the money trail. I think you have to follow who is going to be who has the most to gain here. I'm going to mention Al Gore, and that is, again, is there a problem with global warming? There's, you know, my opinion is, I think that the debate is still on. We just discovered this week, scientists came out with a report on West Coast warming having absolutely nothing to do with human beings, and rather with the shifts in the winds and the Pacific Oscillation. However, that being said, the fact that there is a problem, the fact that we do need to be good steward of the earth, that there does need to be changes, that there does need to be awareness, can so easily be exploited. The way 9/11 was exploited to bring about the Patriot Act, you can take an issue that is important and then exploit it that in a way that is absolutely damaging or more so than the original issue. And so I'm not in favor of the carbon tax. I think that a lot of it has to do, and here I'm going to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but I'm going to bring up Agenda 21, and I think it just goes along that narrative, and it's going to further that agenda. That's my take of it.
I'm going to state a few things to what you said. As people know, and I don't hide it, I'm a Green Party member, and we, as much as I don't like to tout, you know, party or, you know, specific candidates on this show, on this particular show, I don't believe in corporations being charged. I just don't believe in the carbon tax thing, and even when you go to the Green Party platform, it talks about that, and I think we're the only party that actually has that entered into our platform, if I'm not mistaken. I think we are the only one. But I don't believe that's like allowing companies to pay for how much they're going to pollute, and it doesn't make any sense to me when, as an environmentalist, there should be no pollution. And the pollution should end, but it would have to mean a radical change in how all of us live, not just environmentalists, but everybody on the planet. And there's, you know, millions of people that aren't going to go for that. And I do believe in Agenda 21, even though many of the Green Party people that I do know do not understand what it is. And if they do, if they've heard of it, they don't believe it. So I have looked at the Agenda 21 myself. In fact, I don't even know if it's still online, but it used to be in its entirety, and you could read the whole thing. It might be on the UN website still, but it is mentioned on the UN website, that I know. So it definitely is a document that exists, and people should know what it says. And Sherry, have you got anything to say about that?
Yeah, just a little bit. I'm more inclined to agree with you, Anita. I think really, if you take, and again, we have to shut the media out, particularly corporate paid for media, out long enough to think. And you have to think rationally. You have to think logically. And that means you got to use that noodle, you know, and not a computer, you know, not a muse, with your own mind, and use logic. And you know, Mike Rupert, one of the most important things, in my opinion, that he ever said and taught was a finite planet with infinite growth. That's really all that needs to be said, because this is a finite planet, and we are experiencing and will continue to experience infinite growth, and something does have to give. And in my opinion, anybody that cannot look at pure simple logic like that and strip everything else away, I don't understand what it would take to get through to them. It's just like our houses. You know, our houses get dirty because we pollute it, so we have to clean it. But we don't have the capability to clean certain aspects of the earth, and those are the aspects that we thrive, we physically as human animals thrive from.
Mm-hmm. So this question's going out to both of you. Do you think that this climate march accomplished anything? And do you think if a second one is done and a third one, if it will accomplish anything? Do you think there's some type of long-term strategy that will make it work, make our leaders know that we have to have some radical changes on our planet, done by all citizens, not just a few, to make the changes?
I'd like to answer that, Anita. There was an editorial in the Washington Post after the march, and I just dug it up right now because it really struck a chord with me. And it really is relevant to what we're talking about the media and all of that and what they choose to share with the masses and what they choose not to. It's a very short letter to the editor of the Washington Post. It's dated September 26th, and it's titled, "A Massive Climate Change March That Was Missed." It says, "As one of more than 300,000 people who marched against climate change in New York City on September 21st, I was stunned to find no report in the next day's post on this unprecedented gathering. Instead, the largest global warming march in history was given just one paragraph in an otherwise excellent but separate story focused mostly on a philanthropy divesting from fossil fuels. How big does a march have to be, in the Post's view, to warrant more than a paragraph? Does it take 1 million people to finally get an article about the remarkable explosion of U.S. grassroots activism in recent years on global warming? Few causes of any kind have brought together so many people in the United States. Something big is happening in the United States. The tide of history is shifting against the fossil fuel barons who have dominated our politics and our polluted atmospheres for years, admirably and unusually." The Post ran a five-part series of editorials in August of this year calling for stepped-up national and international action on climate change. Sadly, when the biggest action to date by far finally happened, the Post gave it a few lonely sentences. Even the photos of the march that ran in the paper showed isolated individual demonstrators instead of a panning shot of Central Park West flooded with marchers from all 50 states. And unfortunately, Anita, I believe that that's how it's going to continue.
I think that
go ahead.
I'm sorry to cut in. I absolutely agree. I think that on every issue that's important to the American people, and I've noticed this with other marches and protests, when they show up en masse, the corporate media, the mainstream media, misses it in ways where you can't miss it, where it is recorded, where it is on cameras, and it's almost like you have to edit to hide the fact that the response was so large. And again, I think that goes to further one chosen narrative. I do think, however, if Americans continue to show up and are active and do speak out, speak with their neighbors, embrace alternative media, continue to share alternative media, then the truth eventually comes out. I mean, they don't have a monopoly on the truth in corporate media.
So, did you all hear that in a lot of ways the march had been co-opted by polluters? Did you all hear any of that? Because I was hearing that, but yet I didn't read anything about that or see any evidence of that. Did you all hear anything like that?
I had heard a little bit about that. Typically, you know, there were climate marches all over the country, not just the one big one. There were smaller ones going on. There was some of that going on and talked about in the local media in Portland, Oregon. But the reality is anybody who's gone on marches multiple times for a particular issue, there's always provocateurs. Some of the provocateurs are just people of opposing views. Some of the provocateurs are people of authority. And a lot of times the ones that are of authority are there to provoke where it turns into a negative thing and they can paint us all crazy. And that's pretty much the same, reasoning for the ones that are just of different mind. Everybody's got free speech. We have our right to, assemble and peacefully assemble. The thing is that people do that all the time. But really sadly, and I hate to say this, but a lot of people talk the talk and they don't walk the walk. And, I'm even guilty of it myself. But, I know major environmentalists that talk about, don't remove crystals, from the earth, but yet they are all day long on a laptop or a desktop computer that utilizes those crystals to work, So, I mean, we got to pick our poison, right? As far as polluters, I heard that there was some of that going on. Usually that's what the media will focus on. It's the negative. But sadly, activists, regardless of what they're there for, they still drop and, and do things. And if they're there for something to do with the environment, then it's going to get nitpicked, the minute somebody drops a can or is using a can for that matter.
One of the things I've noticed over the years, and I know it's going to happen tomorrow, we're having a big it won't be big because it's hard to galvanize the peace community, but I'm sure it will be bigger tomorrow than most days. There's a corner right outside of MacDill Air Force Base where the peace community is always gathered and done, direct action, peaceful protests for peace against war. And, of course, CENTCOM is right there at MacDill, so everything that's happening in the Middle East is being directed right out of CENTCOM at MacDill. So Tampa's the headquarters for that. In fact, when President Obama was here last week, that's where he went and got his briefing, was right there at CENTCOM. It tied up half the city. But in any case, my issue has always been if the media doesn't cover it, it's like it didn't happen. If the mainstream media doesn't cover that peace event, it's like it did not exist. It's like the tree falling in the forest, and if there's no one there to hear it, it didn't make a sound. Do you know what I'm saying? It's
right.
That's kind of like the same concept. So what do we need to do as media people to try to galvanize the peace community again? Because essentially for the past 8 years, the peace community has been pretty close to being dead in the water.
Right.
And now that a lot of Americans know what's at stake, and I don't think this is a party issue. I think it's both parties. I think the left and the right and everybody in between are really, really not wanting endless war. I think everybody's just about had enough. What can you speak to that, Christine? What do you think? Do you think there's ways to galvanize the peace community now that we need it more than ever?
Absolutely. That's what I was trying to speak of with regard to the march and the fact that it doesn't get coverage, that it doesn't evoke change. I think you have to be consistent. I think it's going to take large numbers of people, but it's going to take people in alternative media. And listen, I think a lot of responsibility rests with the average student, the average citizen, and that is, you don't have to work for NBC. You don't have to have a radio show. You don't even need an alternative blog or an alternative. It's keeping that conversation going in your daily circles. And I think really what we need to do is achieve critical mass. And that can be less than 10% of a population has been shown to evoke great change. The point is to continue the conversation and to continue the momentum and the activism.
I'm inspired. I'm inspired by your words. And I wish I could go to that.
So.
Yeah, I wish I could go to that thing tomorrow, but actually I'll be on my way to Georgia to actually attend Jimmy Carter's Sunday school that he does on Sunday morning up there in Plains, Georgia. So this is going to be really exciting for me. I don't go to Sunday school. I'm not a church-going person, but a friend said, hey, you want to do this? You want to meet Jimmy Carter? We don't have a lot of time. He's 89 years old. We're going to do this. We better do it soon. And apparently the Secret Service comes in first, and they search everybody. Everybody goes into the Sunday school, and it's open to anybody who wants to go. And you watch him teach the Sunday school, and then afterwards you have an opportunity to have a picture taken with him and, you know, exchange a few words with him. And there's nobody that really, really worked so hard on Middle East peace during his presidential time in office than Jimmy Carter. And I really think he's been quite the humanitarian since he got out of office with Habitat for Humanity and so many other things he's done here in this, you know. So I have some deep respect for the man, and it'll be an opportunity to shake his hand and get a picture taken. So I'm definitely going to have a story. But Sherry, can you speak a little bit to anything else that Christine didn't say about getting the peace movement going again? And I think Christine's word was consistent, and yeah, I have to agree with that. Do we have to shout it from the rooftop? Yeah, because it's going to be really, really hard. It's really hard to even get people to come to a meeting of any kind.
It is. But, you know, when Christine was talking about the climate change stuff, and she was saying, you know, each year, you know, keep going, I was going to chime in, but we went to something else, but it fits here. You know, after this burnout, we've all experienced it. Whatever your pet issues are that you go in the streets or you donate to or whatever, you know, when you're doing it as long as many of us have, it becomes very expensive. It becomes alienating from your family, and it becomes tiresome when you see nothing happening and you don't see accurate reporting year after year after year. And, you know, thank God, you know, for each, you know, successive generation that, you know, can come in and kind of fill some shoes. But what it takes in that consistency is, like when Christine was saying, you know, it's not just, you know, you don't need to have a blog to talk about it and this, that, and the other. It goes beyond that, Anita. We have to start living our truth, okay? That means that we don't just care about an issue and do something about it and talk about it when there's a post or there is an event and, you know, or something in the news. If your thing is climate change and the environment, and, you know, everybody should care about the environment. I mean, this is our earth, but, you know, if that's your big pet issue, then you shouldn't be drinking out of plastic bottles. You shouldn't be, you know, and if you're not living your life, then the people that know you're out there doing these things but see you living differently, you're never going to reach them. You're only going to continue to reach people in the choir. We have to reach outside of our choirs. We talk to our choir really well. We don't talk well outside of it.
That's a good point. A very good point. What do we need to do, if anything, as journalists to continue to bring truth? What is the thing that we should be focusing on? Should we be selective in picking the issues? Should we focus on one issue? Should we do live reporting? Should we do street reporting? And what can give us credibility?
What I'll say real quick to that is, you know, as journalists, one of the best things that we can do is write a better story. You know, we see these stories in the news, and for us that are trying to do better and be better, and really make sure that the American people know the truth. Most people don't realize this. The FCC came to be, media came to be. It was supposed to be a public service, and it was supposed to be truth. although that was never written in the law. And in 2004, you know, as us three women know, but in 2004, Fox News, which all the other corporate media signed on to the appeal, they won a Florida Supreme Court, you know, ruling. Basically, the media can legally lie. They were able to win that ruling, that appeal, because it's not actually written in stone that the media has to tell the truth. So that was a huge precedent, you know. And 2004, that was after 9/11. We had copious amounts of propaganda at the time. So if we're telling a story, or we care about a story that we hear and we see that it's wrong, instead of just bitching that it's wrong, then maybe we need to write a better story and call out what's wrong, take away the rhetoric, you know, take away all the embellishment to it that is meant to tug your heart or inflame your mind with anger or whatever, and put a better story out there and be consistent with that and doing that. You did say, can we, you know, should we focus on one thing? Should we, you know, focus on everything? No one media outlet, let alone one media person, can focus on a whole lot of issues. We can dabble in a whole lot of issues, but we're not going to do really well when we do that. We do need to find our focuses. And so I know a lot of journalists who take a lot of flack because they don't cover X, Y, and Z, but they're doing a brilliant job on ABC. And I try to point that out. And if they were doing X, Y, and Z also, they wouldn't do such a brilliant job on ABC. So we need to figure out where the holes are, and we need to fill those holes. And then, like I said, we need to write better stories about the stuff that is being put out there.
And Christine, you have anything else to add to that?
Absolutely. Oh, I agree with Sherry. Is there's only so much you can cover, and only so much you can cover extremely well. So you're limited to your scope. I think where you can do the greatest damage, as it were, for the case of truth, would be to aim at the knee. And that is where all journalists that are in the alternative media can set aside time to focus on, and that is to challenge the narrative with corporate media, to challenge the rhetoric, to talk about and write about the history of the huge propaganda beast that it is. Because if you can do one thing, and that is bring to light the fact that people are being told how to think, being taught how to think, that they're purposely given a set narrative for a certain end, if you can get them to distrust the mainstream media, then you're going to win people over. And then your stories don't have to be better, because they're automatically going to. And I think that we are finding that the public is growing very wary of mainstream media. The more people come over to the alternative side, it may not be the Pulitzer Prize-winning article, but they're reading it, and they're reading it because they've been taught to challenge the untruth that they're being told with mainstream media. I also, again, want to speak to what Sherry said with your daily life, and that is walking your talk and living it out. Not only living out whatever your pet peeve is, whether it's environmental or whatever, in your daily life, but also my kids will say that I can't get through a grocery store line or ride a bus or a subway without giving a speech and talking to people. Wherever I am, I share. And wherever I am, I launch a conversation, and I challenge people to think, and I challenge them to challenge everything they've ever been told. And yeah, I get a short time maybe with the person on the bus, but they're going to walk away, and it's going to plant a seed in them, and they'll search for truth, because ultimately, no one should be the purveyors of truth. You should not trust me because I'm saying it. I merely want to challenge people to think and do their own research. I can't tell you what to know, but hopefully I can inspire you to look into it and find the truth. I teach my children also to do small things. My 9-year-old runs a Liberty lemonade stand, believe it or not, and one of that inspired that was a kickback against children being fined across the country for running a simple lemonade stand. Well, I taught my child civil disobedience. I said, we're going to rebel. We're going to have a lemonade stand every weekend. and we're going to tell people why we're doing it. And, you know, we can also raise money, awareness for certain things, but we can also have a discussion on democracy in this country, on government overreach. And my 9-year-old went to school and began preaching the gospel of libertarianism with her fellow friends, and I went to pick her up, and all these little kids asking questions. So I think there is no circle too small where you
right.
can't effect a change.
Right. And I think, as you said, you know, I said I was green and you said you were libertarian. I think the lines between the third parties are becoming blended. There's
right.
a lot about libertarianism that I really, really love. And you know, I, as much as I'm a dedicated Green, I have a lot of libertarian friends, and we all think very much alike about, you know, many of the issues. And I think when we look at those numbers of who voted for Obama, I think it was the number I got, and I can't remember where I got this number, but somebody shared it with me, and I can't remember what stat they got it from, but only 17% of Americans, no, 17% of the registered voters in this country voted Obama in, 17%.
Wow.
That, if that
wow.
number is true, that means it's an extremely small number that even think their vote counts and go to the ballot box.
Right.
You know? 42% voters are independent voters. That means they're third parties like you and me. So that is, that too is a huge discrepancy, you know, because the mainstream media would like us to think that it's 50-50, Democrat and Republican. And it's, you know, when the polls come out, it's 47-53 or whatever numbers they're giving us. And they make people believe that those numbers are true numbers of voters and people going to the polls. And that's just not true. 42% independent. That means libertarians, Greens, constitutional, socialist, whatever it may be. We are the majority in this country.
We are. And Anita, you just reminded me of a very important hashtag for everybody, is Vote No Evil. What Anita's saying, and we're talking about, is this is not a Republican-Democrat country. It's not. There's much more outside of those parties. But what happens is people will, quote-unquote, vote the lesser of the two evils. So trending hashtag, you know, you guys, listeners, you know, help us out here. It's, we need to start voting issues, not politicians. And so hashtag vote no evil. Thank you, Scott Ford. you know, start using that when you're talking about things with regards to election. People need to remember, that was a big thing with Kucinich, who I adore. And I knew so many people that wanted him and had worked the campaigns in different states and stuff like that. But they, you know, I know a lot of them that when it came down to it, they figured it would be a throwaway vote. So they voted the lesser of the two evils.
And I'm proud to say that I worked as staff on his campaign, and I adore him as a person, him and Elizabeth. And, you know, I'm still in touch with him. And I think he's accomplishing even more while being out of office now.
Dude was at Burning Man.
He went to Burning Man. It was pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So he he's very conservative. So there was an article that was put out about him being at Burning Man wearing, like, regular pants and a dress shirt, you know.
Right.
And I don't think I've ever seen him outside of a dress shirt or a suit, you know. So I don't think you're going to change him now. I'm certainly pretty sure he wasn't going to be running around Burning Man with a Speedo on or anything. you know, he did talk, and, of course, anywhere he goes, he's mobbed like a rock star. So, you know, the people love him, and he's definitely more a statesman than he is a politician. I consider him a statesman.
Yeah.
But I remember those times of trying to get him out of the crowd, you know, and get him moved to a different location. and he would just be mobbed, and he didn't want to stop talking to people, and people didn't want to stop talking to him either. But I have talked to him before, sent him a few emails, a few nudges, and asked him why he hasn't joined the Green Party, because most of his take on the issues is a very green one. And he was the only vegan in Congress, and he was definitely on top of the whole issue of safe food way before anybody else was talking about it. So, you know, a lot of pluses in that direction, and, you know, there's always a future of him running, but, you know, it could happen. Who knows? He's still pretty young, in his early 60s, so... But I wouldn't mind working for him again, I will say that. And the other candidate, of course, that I loved working with was Cynthia McKinney, who was the first black woman that ran for president with the Green Party ticket. And it was a dual ticket with Rosa Clemente. So, and those were some really, really good times. But that was one of the reasons why I left the Democratic Party, was when I saw how the Democratic Party treated Dennis. That was enough for me. As soon as that campaign was over, within the week, I was kind of sitting there twiddling my thumbs going, what the hell do I do next? I have no idea. I was, after 18-hour and 20-hour days for, you know, over a year, all of a sudden I didn't have anything to do, and it kind of freaked me out. But then I started to think back on everything the Dems had done to him and everything they had done to discourage him. And I said, I've had enough. And I went down to the supervisor of elections and turned green. I had talked to a few of the Greens here in Florida, and I said, I think that, and I read the platform, and I said, this is for me. This is where I belong. And that's why I switched. But in so doing, it's really opened up my relationships with so many other people. Like I said, that other 42% of all of us that are third parties, it's really opened up so I can talk to people about issues that we are thinking along the same lines. Our takes on the issues are the same. We've even tried out here in Florida ranked choice voting. We've even had like certain counties that have tried different ways of approaching the ballot box, and it never goes past a small contingent of people working on these things within a county or something, because our current election system is so flawed. Do you all have anything to add to that, or any experiences, or?
You know, with regards to you switching parties, you know, most people that follow me are my readers, you know, or Facebook followers and stuff. I don't belong to a political party. I only registered for a political party when I had to vote in the primary. So states are a little different in how you do that. I don't consider myself belonging to any political party, and because to me, that's a popularity contest about the person and not the issues. Again, and the way I look at this, I was one of those people that was raised to believe that my vote didn't matter. I didn't vote for the first half of my adulthood because I was believed it was electoral colleges and so on and so forth. You know, that's all changed now, and you know, for me. And but these political parties, it's like people try to always cage me in. You know, I got like people on the, you know, Republicans, they don't like me because of X, Y, and Z, and liberals don't like me because of X, Y, and Z, and libertarians don't like me because of X, Y, and Z. But then they all like me for, you know, the other letters in the alphabet. You know, so, I mean, it's like, again, really, is there going to be any politician in any office that's going to be 100%? No, not ever going to happen. And, you know, that's why we get all this lesser two evil crap. So what we need to do is we need to really start looking at these issues, and we need to find a better system where it isn't a political party system, where it's an issue-based system. And that's just my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to the end. Actually, we've gone a few minutes over. We can keep going, or we can close now. It's up to y'all if you want to keep talking, because I've got more questions.
If you ladies would like to stay, I know I would like to talk a little bit about creative activism.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Go ahead. What would you like to say about it?
Well, I think people get stuck in a box, and I always say that you cannot think out of the box when you're in the box, because you can't see out of the box when you're in the box. And, you know, we need to, you know, it's great to go to a march. It's great to, you know, strengthen numbers and have that visibility, even though the media don't cover it properly. But also, you know, in living our lives and doing, you know, having it integrated in our daily lives and stuff. But there's lots of different things that people can do creatively, you know, for activism for their issues versus just stand on corners with signs or march down the road with signs or get on Facebook and post stories and stuff like that. And, you know, some of those things back in the days following 9/11, there were like deception dollars that had come out. And they were really kind of cool. You know, they had several different versions of them, but was just chock full of websites and just really cool. But they looked like money, although bigger. And, you know, people were buying these and giving them away and, you know, passing them out. And as soon as, you know, people, you put it in someone's hand that didn't care about it and saw what it was, they didn't want it. At first they thought it was money and would try to take it, you know. And so, yeah, they were a neat novelty item. But what I started doing and started getting people to do is I'd wad them up. I had a bunch of these in my pockets, and I'd wad them up. And everywhere I went, I'd drop them. I'd put them on grocery store shelves, toss them in open windows of cars and parking lots, you know, drop them in parking lots, you know, wherever. Because what happens when people see money in public, and when you wadded it up, there was no way to tell it was in a real bill of some sort. And, you know, people pick up money. If they're not going to turn it in right away, then they try to do it discreetly and they stick it in their pocket and they don't open it up to see what their prize is until they're out of the vicinity. So, you know, they're going home and or getting in their car at least, and now they got deception dollars that's in their hands, you know. So that's one creative way with something like that. Bloggers for Peace is an organization that I got involved with and helped build a couple years ago. And you can find it on WordPress, Bloggers for Peace, as well as on Facebook. And one of the things that we talked about is, you know, different ways to promote that. And because it's, everything is about peace, and what Bloggers for Peace do is everybody that blogs, they commit to one peace post a month, you know, and it's got a hashtag and so on and so forth. Well, I created these little flyers based off of Water Cooler Media. And Water Cooler Media is when you go and you're at a club or you're somewhere and you at an airport and you go and you sit on the toilet to go pee, and on the stall door in front of you is advertisements. And that was a brilliant conception, the people that came up with that. So, you know, I made this little thing that was this little poem. If you all remember the old poem, "Here I Sit and Thought I Fart," you know, all that. So kind of based on that, and it was, you know, this whole Bloggers for Peace thing. And so the whole thing was, you know, these fit in your purse or your wallet. You know, you can just stick them in the bathrooms, wherever you go, you know, and that was something that worked. So it doesn't matter what your issue is. There's creative things that you can be doing daily. Don't wait until there's a march in your, you know, community. One of the things that I personally do is I do what's called a letter and song titles. And it's very creative. I do it on my website. It's a series I do. And almost every, they're call to action letters. And they're not long letters or anything. But almost every single word or phrase in them is an actual song title. And they're linked to their appropriate YouTube videos. And every time I write one of these, they just get all over the place. And people get excited about it. And they get passed around and passed around. Because they're fun to read, because now it's an interactive game. But yet it's a whole activist message. And it's a call to action. And so, you know, like I said, there's lots of creative things that we can do. We need to step out of that box for a minute and take a good look around. You know, we need to evolve with everything, and we need to not just be keyboard cowboys. Sitting on your computer, doing nothing but posting news stories or commenting mm-hmm. on someone's news stories is not really activism. That's being a lazy activist, unless that's all you can do. If that's all you can do because you're in a wheelchair or you're homebound or whatever, or, you know, you don't have a car, you can't get out there, you're somewhere way rural, you know, or whatever, but you have to realize that there is much more that can be done than sitting behind there saying, oh, I'm going to share that story that I didn't read, but I like the headline and my friend posted it, so it must be true. You know, sharing is not always caring, and so that's another part of activism and being creative about it is, you know, I don't care if it's Anita that posts something. I'm not going to just arbitrarily hit the share button without looking at it. And that means click on it, open it up, read more than the headline, make sure it's legit. And prime example, a friend of mine that I've known for years on Facebook posted a story about an Ebola story, and it was saying that, now it may or may not be true, but the point is still valid. The story was from some site I've never heard, you know, one of these small little sites like mine, you know, and it said that the Ebola vaccine only works on white-skinned people. Now, this person posted this and, you know, gets a lot of, you know, WTF response comments and stuff like that. And it says that the CDC put out a statement, blah, blah, blah. First thing I do is I go to the CDC's website and I read every single statement that the CDC had put out that's on their site. I read the press releases. I read their updates. There was nothing about this anywhere on the CDC site. The story that was posted had no link to their source, just said the CDC put out a statement. So I started Googling the different words of the story and, you know, and the vaccine. I found two other stories. One was almost the exact same story, like it was just somebody that had regurgitated the same thing. Again, no link to the source. And then another one was an Onion piece, and it said that the vaccine was 50 white people away or something silly like that. You know, and needless to say, I still haven't seen that, you know, like authenticated anywhere. It doesn't mean it's not true, because we know from P2OG, we know that they do have stuff that's DNA specific. With their biowarfare stuff with the United States government that works on your genes. But I don't know that that's very true, you know, and I've seen a lot of people were trying to share it and commenting and had opinions and were getting uptight and, you know, and stuff like that. That's how these things happen. And, you know, the powers that be, part of, like, with the police brutality and the racism aspects of all of that, you know, and using these things to politicize their sound bites, their things that get out there, provocateurs put stuff out there to intentionally inflame and rile up. So we need to vet. We cannot be irresponsible, and whether you're a journalist or not, somebody posts something, you don't just share it. You got to read it. You got to make sure it's real, you know, because it's not. You got to think about everything. Every time you share something on social media, it's not like you're talking to your neighbor over the fence. You may as well be at the Super Bowl on national TV live, you know, and so, and it just, you know, it's not he told two friends. It's he told 2,000 friends, he told 5,000 friends, he told 2 million friends. And that's how this bullshit works for these people that are doing it, and we need to stop that.
Christine, do you have anything to add to that?
Absolutely. It is what everything Sherry said is every bit so important. And honestly, sometimes it can't even be let's go back to the idea of the provocateur in a march and in a rally, and they're there to stir up trouble. They're there to breed illegitimacy on the side of the activists and the issues that are being campaigned about. Likewise, over the internet, you can have provocateurs that are purposely distilling misinformation. These activists grab at it, people grab at it, post it. You're not only doing harm by not vetting a story to the particular issue, you're doing harm to the genre of social media and independent journalism. So it's ultimately so important to vet the story for the cause, for the future of independent journalism, and because you unknowingly can absolutely be assisting provocateurs by not vetting a story.
And you know, Christine, also it lends to their own credibility as a human being too. And, you know, so all of that negative stuff also reflects on them as an individual.
Correct.
You know, I want to point out something. Anybody listening to tonight's Anita's show tonight could have picked up on that us three women, we don't agree on everything together, and we're having a very civil conversation. You know, debates, there's a winner and a loser, and not everything needs to be a debate, because when it's a debate, we all lose. And conversations and community is what we need more of, and we need to realize that without it, none of this stuff is going to stop, and we can't get solutions without real conversations. And it's okay if if Christine and I or Anita and I or Anita and Christine disagree on something. That's what I was saying about no matter who's in the White House, there's going to be things about that person we don't like. You know, it doesn't matter. There's going to be things, and some of those things are going to be horrible, you know. But, you know, that's how people are. We're all human beings. You know, we're all human beings. It don't matter what our title is.
That's right. That's right.
Absolutely.
And we don't all have to think alike, and that's one of the good things about being an American is we don't have to all think alike.
Right.
I do my best to remain unprogrammed. I don't let the TV program me. I don't let people program me, and my thoughts are my own. And I hope other people do the same, but, you know, sometimes you can almost tell, you know, with that aside, sometimes you can almost tell who's been watching Fox News. Am I right?
Oh, yeah, for sure. For sure.
I mean, they're spouting the same stuff, and I'll say, where did you get that? And I'll say, Fox News, right? And they go, yeah. And I'll go, do you
proud of it?
Yeah. Do you understand that that's not even really news? It's a lot of it's not even true. So
right.
I live in a very conservative community, so I hear some of these things which are quite surprising. But anyway, I think we've come to a good ending, and I just wanted to leave you all some time for some closing comments. Christine, what can you tell us as far as closing comments? And we also, all three of us, have an announcement as well. So.
Yes.
So I'm going to kind of open that up.
Okay. My closing comments really, and I've stated it earlier in our conversation, but it's a running theme for me, and that is to own your own truth. Don't be talked to. Don't be a passive learner. Truth isn't something that's held by an authority, and by that, I don't care if it's a pastor, a teacher, the newscaster, the president, or even any of us. You cannot be a passive recipient in truth. You have to actively engage yourself in the quest for truth, in the quest for knowledge, and distill all the bits and pieces of information, arrive at conclusions, and ultimately, the only way you're going to arrive at real truth is not to take sound bites, and not to give anyone the authority over truth. And then, as we talked about earlier on the conversation, not to be an armchair activist, not to hold on to that information or feel like your opinions or that you're too small to do anything about it. But wherever you are, wherever your circle is, I don't care if that's a supermarket line, if it's engaging with the neighbors around you, if it's finding ways, like Sherry said, there are so many different creative ways to go about activism, but find ways to share information and to perpetuate the sharing of that information and to inspire others to do so. And ultimately, critical mass is something that is so important to me, and critical mass is not a majority. It took less than 10% of Americans, they were not, the ragtag army were not in the popular, to launch a revolution and to create this nation. People don't realize that this was not a majority of citizens standing up against the redcoats. It was less than 10%. Once you achieve critical mass, you can effect great change. And so not to be disheartened by the fact that you're alone and that there's so few of you or us, but to keep on keeping on and to understand you're not looking to change everybody, just enough.
Right.
Yeah, that's great.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's very profound.
That's exactly what it says, very profound.
And Cherie, closing comments?
Yeah, just everything that Christine just said right there, but just to take it one step further, we need to be humble in the sense of how we are approaching others. when we're trying to talk to people at the grocery store, at the library, at the gas station, wherever we may be, we can't all of a sudden get wrinkled because they disagree with us or they say something we disagree with. Because, you know, the whole you catch more flies with honey is true. And, you know, you can't try to educate people and give them everything at once. It's overwhelming. You can't bark at them. You can't be condescending to them. None of that is a conversation. And in order to breed curiosity, you need to be able to conversate, because that's where the enlightenment comes from. And the curiosity comes from them genuinely having an interest in what you're saying. And they're not going to have an interest in what you're saying if you're barking at them, if you're short with them, if you're demeaning to them, or you're giving them too much, you know, at a time. So we need to humble ourselves in how we interact. We need to reach outside of the choir. I'm so tired. I love my fellow choir members, but I'm really, really tired of always talking to the choir when we do events. You know, we have people traveling around doing conferences all across the country and outside of the country for one issue or another. And the people that fill the seats, the butts in those seats, are just more choir members like us. You know, why are we flying around fellow activists to talk to ourselves when we really need to be talking to the people that don't know what we know? And finding the way to talk to them, finding the way to reach them. If not, then we need to completely segregate ourselves from each other and have at it. I mean, there's no other way. And so it comes with a humbleness, and we need to get back to humanity.
I want to do a closing quote, one of my favorite quotes, and then we can make our announcement. So I'm going to just read this quote by Erin Dottie Roy, which really is one of the most amazing things she's ever said. So here goes. Our strategy should be not only to confront empire, but to lay siege to it, to deprive it of oxygen, to shame it, to mock it. With our art, our music, our literature, our stubbornness, our joy, our brilliance, and our sheer relentlessness, and our ability to tell our own stories, stories that are different from the ones we're being brainwashed to believe. The corporate revolution will collapse if we refuse to buy what they are selling, their ideas, their version of history, their wars, their weapons, their notion of inevitability. Remember this, we be many, they be few. They need us more than we need them. Another world is not only possible, she is on her way. On a quiet day, I can hear her breathing. It's,
wow.
It's just,
that is so,
it's just
beautiful.
Amazing.
I got chills.
Every time I read
it,
I just become so inspired. I mean, it's just
yeah.
one of the most incredible quotes. Well, it's a paragraph, but just an amazing thing, because she just lays it all out there. She covers everything in that one paragraph.
And you know what?
And what a word. Yes?
I'm sorry. I was just going to say, you know what she covers in that paragraph is everything that we just spoke on, really. You know,
exactly.
About how we need to live our lives out loud this way and not be secreted for events. Or a podcast,
right.
Or a post. We need to live and breathe it.
Exactly. So we are going to, at this time, announce our new radio show. We are going to continue on with Wise Women Media. That's not going to end. So I want to just encourage everybody, you can check us out next week, Friday night, 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. We're going to be doing a very comprehensive interview with a panel of people that are involved with Block the Boat Tampa. They're going to tell us a lot about Middle East politics, about the conflict between Israel and Palestine, and some long-term strategy and information about the BDS movement and, of course, Block the Boat. So it's going to be an interesting show, and I encourage everybody to listen in. You'll get more information probably when I do the promo for it, which will be Monday or Tuesday of this coming up week. On Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we're going to be launching, this will be October 1st, we'll be launching our first show, Christine will be involved and Sherry will be involved, and as well as a host of other writers and journalists and possibly broadcasters too. It's going to be called Challenging the Rhetoric, which is exactly what we did here tonight. And
yep.
You can find us on Twitter at Rhetoric Versus Facts. You can find us on Facebook under Challenging the Rhetoric. We have a website already, thanks to Sherry, challengingtherhetoric.com. And is there anything else I need to tell the listeners about?
Just on the show, with Challenging the Rhetoric, it's a full female endeavor, which I think is an interesting concept. You know, from tech to talent, it's all women that are doing this at this point, this far, and that's how we're launching it. You know, Anita had a great idea, and I think it's going to be really catchy. I feel very positive about it, Anita and Christine, and I think Christine's going to be a real strong component to this, and it's nice that we have a mixture of opinions and voices and can do it civilly. But the show is going to be very interesting because we will have men guests on the show. We're going to put them on the grill. They'll be in the hot seat, and it's going to be a really rapid-fire Q&A session. We have some really great things coming with the show. If you think about a typical radio show that you hear on your regular dial in your car or on your stereo, it's going to only an hour long, but it's still going to be formatted like that. We will be having contests. That are going to be interactive, that'll involve the website as well as the social media and the show itself. So please do go check out the website, challengingtherhetoric.com, the Facebook, challengingtherhetoric.com, and on Twitter, Rhetoric Versus Fact. Start following us. I'm using the hashtag CTR. I want to start getting that to trend. So if you're listening, please start using that.
Use hashtag CTR, and I've been using hashtag challenging the rhetoric as well when I put out anything from the Twitter account. And it's good. Use it all. I think just using it all would be wonderful. You know.
And the brilliance of the name that Anita had come up with for the whole concept, and as well as the hashtags, is that it's going to be universal for anything that's current event or news in general that we're tweeting and or posting or sharing into other shows, Google Plus and whatnot. It's a very trendable, if we do it right, it's very trendable because it applies. Anything you post with the news where you know there's lies in it, do the hashtag. And then that'll make it start trending really good. But I do want to thank the listeners that have already been participating on the page, on the website as well as the Facebook page, for the last couple weeks almost now that we soft launched it. October 1st is the launch of Challenging the Rhetoric as a whole, as an entity. We need more writers. We are looking for some more on-air talent. These are all volunteers at this point. We are all volunteers at this point. So find us on Facebook or hit us up through the website. There's contact form on there. If you want to get involved, we'd love to have you. We want women's voices all around the world. This is not just a USA thing. So if you're in Bangladesh, you know, or Japan, I don't care where you're at. If you want to write for us, you know, please do contact us.
And this will be, so let me just repeat when the radio shows will be. Wednesday, 7 o'clock, that's Eastern Standard Time on Blog Talk Radio. Just do a search for Challenging the Rhetoric. I believe I have posted it already on Facebook, the link to the first show. So you can go to the Facebook page and actually get to the show through there. Friday night, Wise Women Media, that's 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, will be interviewing a panel of people from Block the Boat Tampa.
Awesome. So
we'll go ahead and close for tonight. I want to thank both of you, Christine Coe and Sherry Roberts, for being on the show. And, wow, what an engaging and enlightening conversation. And I think we really definitely solidified our ability to keep a conversation going for a long period of time and cover a multitude of topics as we did. It was quite interesting. And we're going to close with a wonderful song called I'm Just a Girl by Gwen Stefani and No Doubt. And we'll see you. We'll see y'all later. Have a great weekend. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you, Anita.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.